Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 620, interview with Paris Flamand about the masks of New Orleans. This program is being recorded on November 25th of the year 2007. Once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Paris Flamand, the author of, among other titles, The Kennedy Conspiracy, published by the Meredith Press in 1969, and more recently, the four-volume encyclopedic Assassination of America. I should also perhaps mention that Paris Flamand is the former producer of the legendary Long John Nebel show, legendary certainly in the annals of talk radio. Paris, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Good to be here.
We're talking about the masks of New Orleans, and what I'd like to do would be to plunge right back into our discussion of who some of these people are, and I think particularly, Paris, for people who are newer to the story of the New Orleans aspects of the assassination and the real version of the assassination as opposed to the official lies, it's important for us to try to, I think, create a concrete picture of who people like David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald and Guy Bannister were, and how in turn they begin to intersect with some of the more powerful people, people like Carlos Marcello and Clay Shaw. Why don't we start we touched a little bit on Carlos Marcello on side two. He was capo mafioso of New Orleans. Now, how does he intersect with people like Lee Harvey Oswald and David Ferry and Guy Bannister?
Well, he was early on took over the gambling in Louisiana, and he expanded his contacts as was necessary if you were in organized crime in those days and even these. And he got to know Frank Costello, the commonly called the Prime Minister of Crime, who was head of the Genovese family for a while. Marilansky, CEO of the Cosa Nostra, although, of course, he was never at any of the meetings of the actual top capos because he was Jewish. And only Sicilians were in the conferences that were held mostly in upstate New York, but elsewhere later on in Miami and Las Vegas. In any event, Marcello was soon named by the commission, just mentioned, Godfather of New Orleans. And he was, despite certain inconveniences caused by Robert Kennedy, almost the only attorney general who ever went after anybody in corporate crime, he still reigned for about three decades. His influence was so great that despite having uttered threats against the president and the attorney general, Bobby, the FBI quickly announced that he could have nothing to do with JFK's death. And more astonishingly, that Marcello was a tomato salesman and had nothing to do with any kind of crime. It is almost unnecessary to comment on that to one who knows anything about the FBI history.
Perhaps that's the genesis of the term killer tomato.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, that is probably true. The only thing that's really almost incomprehensible about this entire history, as you mentioned, it's four volumes long, 1,850 pages, and that is the one sentence that Jim always took the position that he knew nothing of Marcello's connection with organized crime. But that is another story, and I won't digress on that, but it is a fascinating thing. Now, Marcello was a longtime, of course, godfather in New Orleans, actually New Orleans to Dallas Axis. His power extended far beyond the Crescent City itself. And he played the role to the equivalent of Sam Giancana in Chicago and Santos Trafficante in Miami, and the family heads in New York. His reign was long, and he was regarded almost untouchable until Bobby Kennedy came along in the Attorney General's office, had him summarily dispatched from the country almost in the mid of night to the hinterlands of Guatemala, However, he sneaked back in, and Kennedy now began criminal action against him and sent him to jail, where he spent some time. The noted assassination critic and chief counsel of the House Committee on Assassinations, which concluded that JFK had been killed by a plot, as you noted earlier on, G. Robert Blakey, has written that the conspiracy developed through organized crime and was responsible for the death of the president, although Blakey, at least the last I heard, still opined that Oswald actually did some of the shooting. Yet he recognized that other shots probably came from the grassy knoll. Many astute critics of the assassination believe the animosity created by Robert Kennedy in dealing with Marcello led to his brother's murder and perhaps his own. And Marcello finally, as he used to say in the West, turned in his chips on March 3, 1993. And the reign of organized crime in New Orleans was thought by many people to have diminished considerably, if not extraordinarily, after his demise. On the other hand, there are those that feel the elements just went further underground, and the administrating personnel is keeping a much lower profile. Of course, after Katrina, Lord only knows what remains of the organization.
Well, I noted in the paper just today, Paris, in the San Francisco Chronicle, there was an article about how in many of the previously poorer neighborhoods of New Orleans, they have not built housing for the poor, but casinos are cropping up.
Yes.
In a lot of those areas. So who knows? Perhaps the putative influence of Marcello and company is not as diffuse as you might be inclined to suspect.
Well, my sense is that that's probably, although, of course, it is popular to believe that Vegas is no longer infiltrated by the mob, that is that, of course, conviction is naive in the extreme. And I suspect that Vegas money is coming into New Orleans. That is after years in this area, it's my instincts tell me that that is probably the case. However, you've mentioned a couple of times, and quite rightly so, the importance of David William Ferry in this entire business. And certainly, if anybody had a contact with Ferry, Marcello, it was Ferry. There is considerable evidence that he visited the Capo's luxurious quarters just outside of New Orleans on more than one occasion.
And by the way, David Ferry was the first person whom Jim Garrison indicted.
He was the first, and he was extremely strange. As a matter of fact, I've always felt privileged, if that is not a peculiar use of the word, when Jim sent Lou Ivan with me to go to Ferry's quarters, and I have photographs. As a matter of fact, I think there may be a dozen or 12, 15 photographs of the interior of Ferry's flat in New Orleans in the book, and there were cobwebs over things, and I remember his flyer's hat was actually lying on a coffee table with cobwebs over it, and it was rather eerie. But as for the man himself, he was born in March 28th, 1919, in Cleveland. He was not a New Orleans person initially, and he came from a nice public service family. His father was a policeman who rose to the rank of captain, and he took a law degree. His uncle was a battalion chief in the city's fire department. He was a Roman Catholic who went to St. Patrick's Elementary School and St. Ignatius High School and entered John Carroll University, all Jesuitical institutions. And then in 1938, he entered Cleveland St. Mary's Seminary And I don't think a lot of people realize that his objective in life at an early age was to become a priest. However, according to the priests of the faculty at St. Mary's, he didn't have the, as they call it, the calling, and he was ill-placed in the environment, and he was he decided to transfer to Baldwin-Wallace College in Berea, Ohio, where he received a BA in psychology. I think a great many people who talk about him don't realize that he had a BA in psychology. He reverted to his religious inclinations thereafter, entered St. Charles Seminary in Cartagena, Ohio, in 1941. But his attempts were no more successful than previous ones, and he left after a couple of years to go into flying. He studied at the SkyTech Airway Service, achieving his license from 44 to 48. He taught aeronautics in Benedict High School in Cleveland, and by 1948 he was involved in the 5th Cleveland Squadron of the Civil Air Patrol out of Hopkins Airport. The next year, he was joining the Army Reserve, from which he was dishonorably discharged 3 years later. Let's see, in 1953, already now a skilled pilot, including instrument flying and commercial flight, he was hired by Eastern Airlines at the behest of Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, no less. Afterwards that, he returned to a private career and led the New Orleans contingent of the CAP by 1962 with various other pilots known in the area, Jerry Paradis, George Bush, Tony Etzenhofer, and various other people who were, whose names are familiar to genuine assassination students. This is interesting. A number of historical revisionists are notably ignorant of this portion of his career, and that it was at this time that his path crossed Lee Harvey Oswald's at CAP. That is to say, or demonstrated by a photograph on 632 of Book 2, where the two of them are seen at a cookout of the held by the civilian Civil Air Patrol, and obviously there's a considerable fraternity going on in the photograph. As far as his other activities are concerned, there are many indications that he may have, probably did, run guns for Castro in the early days, but some argue that he turned against that revolutionary or was always opposed to him. So it's a little moved. Among the persons with whom his name was associated were gunrunner Eladio Davale, the Louisiana criminal godfather whom we've mentioned, Carlos Marcello, and possibly Santos Traficante in Miami. All the various other people that are in the web of pro and anti-Cuban activities during that period, Carlos Brunier and Carlos Quiroga and Louis Lavelle. But the main one of all seemed to be in the focal point of this sort of effort was Acacia Smith, sometimes known as just Acacia, and all of these people at one time or another had connection with the company, our term for the CIA. Another very interesting point is that David Ferry, along with a rather shady detective, private detective known as Jack Martin, both claimed not only ordination but consecration in the subsect of the old Catholic Church in North America, which I mentioned, in which Jim was interested because of the various bits of evidence that seemed to indicate some sort of connection between it and participants in this whole complicated network of people who might or might not have been involved in the assassination. But the interesting thing is that the additional interesting thing is that they were not priests, and they claimed that they were not merely priests but bishops as well. In point of fact, they were neither. They were able to support these contentions because of documents issued to them by a very questionable cleric, legitimate cleric, I put the word legitimate in quotes, Carl Maria Stanley, who was known to be a frequent and multiple dispenser of such imaginary orders. So you begin with the investigation, and you come across Bannister, and then Ferry, and then Marcello, and finally you are inevitably led to the key figure, one Clay Laverne Shaw, who is the individual that Jim finally brought to trial, and about whom the reports of the judgment of the verdict are always rather slanted and inaccurate, because the conclusion that we can derive from the comments of the jurors following the trial was, despite the fact that the guilty he was judged not guilty, the many of the jurors were to say that the reason the verdict was as it was that they simply did not have, quote, sufficient proof to go for a beyond a reasonable doubt. And that is a very key in understanding how that trial proceeded. It was not, he was not judged innocent. He was judged not guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Paris, very, very quickly, I want to interject that during the course of the trial itself, Colonel Pierre Fink, one of the military personnel involved in the autopsy of President Kennedy, testified that he was ordered, testified under oath in court, I should say, that he was ordered by superior officers not to dissect the neck wound. That is in and of itself proof of a conspiracy. What I'd like to, we are down to our last 10 minutes of the discussion. What I'd like to do, Paris, would be to sort of reinforce in the minds, particularly of younger and or more innocent, shall we say, listeners, how the anti-Castro efforts that were going on in the southern U.S., in this case in New Orleans in particular, unites David Ferry, Guy Bannister, Lee Harvey Oswald, and Carlos Marcello. And then I'd like to, in our last 10 minutes, bring in Clay Shaw, how he specifically overlaps the anti-Castro Cuban effort, and one thing that we have not discussed, and that is the deaths of some of the key participants. What happened to David Ferry? What happened to the aforementioned Eladio Del Valle? What happened to Guy Bannister, Hugh Ward, Maurice Brooks, Gatlin, and some others? So at the anti-Castro efforts in the southern U.S. and New Orleans, how does that unite the masks of New Orleans?
Well, the entire anti-Castro business began, of course, considerably before the assassination. And as we have mentioned before, we have evidence that David Ferry was involved in gun running there. Eladio Valle was involved in gun running there. As a matter of fact, Bannister may have well been involved, if only on the New Orleans end, by supplying and weapons that were then picked up by others. We know that on a number of occasions that he had cases of arms in his offices. the connection of Shaw is somewhat more ephemeral because it was essentially the input of intelligence activities. One must keep in mind that Shaw was always deeply involved with intelligence agencies. The only curious thing about that complex of activities is that I have never found any evidence that he was involved in naval intelligence, and naval is the key to all American intelligence. It's closely tied to British intelligence. It's the oldest intelligence agency. It's the most complex and complicated and subtlest of all.
And also New Orleans, we should not lose sight of, is the not only the northernmost port of the Caribbean, but also the gateway to the largest commercial waterway in North America, the Mississippi River. As such, a particular focal point of importance for naval intelligence.
Yes, very, very definitely true. As a matter of fact, it's can't bring the three together, but within something like a block and a half in New Orleans at one point, naval intelligence, military intelligence, the FBI and the CIA all had offices within practically throwing distance of one another. So they keep in rather close touch, although on the other hand, of course, the are rather precious about their own operations and quite often don't share much of the information among themselves. The something we haven't mentioned is that Shaw himself had enormous number of connections, and unfortunately we can't get into the we haven't the time for to get into his. A very tight relationship with Permandex and the Centre Mondial et Commercial, both of whom were intelligence operations, among other aspects of their function. But he was a person of while he never had enormous wealth himself, he knew millionaires by the dozens, and he had the support of people of great political power and public contacts. As a matter of fact, one of which was Ted Brandt, who was also in the New Orleans trademark, who by extension was connected with the North American Newspaper Alliance, and that was ultimately operated after various accessions to a higher office by one Sid Goldberg, whom I knew in New York, that he became was always involved with the CIA, and Lucianne, his wife, of course, was the center point of the scandal involving Linda Tripp and the Clinton thing. So, you know, the complexity and the intricacy and the interwovenness, if there were such a word, of all of these people and elements is very difficult to deal with in a short time. And probably in less than about a 24-hour conversation.
Well, you only took four volumes to set forth sort of your views on these relevant matters. So,
and Dave, it was edited. I mean, I edited it down from I would say at least 25%.
And but in the it is suffice it to say that it is the intelligence community. It is the efforts against Castro and other things that helped to cement. The activities that brought many of these people together, some of the works that we've spoken about in the past that supplement some of the material that is in Paris's work, the book Let Justice Be Done by Bill Davey, Destiny Betrayed by Jim DiEugenio, Barry
Both
and the Boys.
Those, by the way, are highly valuable people. They've made major contributions.
Ed Haslam's works, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus and Dr. Mary's Monkey, and also the work of Daniel Hopsicker, Barry and the Boys, tracing Barry Seal's career with the CIA as a drug runner back to his work with David Ferry, and Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans. Very quickly, Paris, before we remind people how they can get a hold of Assassination of America, one thing that we have not talked about, and that is what we could call perhaps New Orleans' greatest hits, the greatest hits of New Orleans, in bullet point fashion, very quickly. I'm going to name some of the key figures who died under strange circumstances, encapsulated, and it's got to be that way, some of their deaths. Start with David Ferry, his Garrison's first indictee. What happened to him?
He allegedly died a natural death. A friend of mine, I don't know if he'd want his name mentioned or not, so I shan't, but who is at one time was the only fifth-degree black belt in karate in the United States, told me when I gave him the report to read, and noting that apparently there was no actual bruising or what have you, and he said, "You learn that when you're a third degree." So he was convinced that he had been killed by a karate chop.
Very quickly, what happened to Guy Bannister?
Bannister, arguably he might have drunk himself to death. Some of these things are, are reported as one thing, and it's very difficult to determine just how unlikely the official evaluation
Very quickly, Paris, we're almost out of time. Guy Bannister died of a heart attack in 64. His aide, Hugh Ward, died in a plane crash about that same time.
Yes.
And also
Maurice... heart attacks are, they're heart attacks and then heart attacks.
They're CIA heart attacks and then they're heart attacks.
Exactly, yes.
And Maurice Brooks Gatlin, another of his investigators, went out of a Panama Hotel with sixth floor window. And then, of course, also Eladio Del Valle, the guy you referred to earlier.
He was murdered. That was brutal. He was, if one believes all the reports, I mean, he was just chopped to pieces.
But the point is, this is one of the things that happened to Jim Garrison's investigation. A lot of the key people died under strange circumstances. One of the places you can read about that is in Assassination of America. Paris, wrap it up by telling people where they can get it.
They can get it by writing to me or to Scanuscription. That's S-C-A-N-U. SCRYPTION at Post Office Box 4848, Scioto, SCIOTA, Pennsylvania, 18354.
Very good. And that is where you can get a hold of the four-volume series, Assassination of America, the latest input on the JFK assassination by Paris Flamond, the earlier author of The Kennedy Conspiracy from 1969, and also the producer of the Long John Nebel Show, legendary in the history of talk radio.
Dave,
yes?
May I also mention that you can just come on the Internet and get me at assassinationofamerica.com. Straight through, no breaks, no caps, no spaces. Just assassinationofamerica.com.
And I will have a link. I'm going to have a written description of, for the record, 6/19 and 20, the two interviews we've done, and I will have links to that in those descriptions, or in that one description for the two shows.
Good talking to you, Dave.
All righty, same here, Paris. Very good. Will do. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record 620 interview with Paris Flamond about the masks of New Orleans. This is being recorded on November 25th of 2007. For Paris Flamond, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.